impact for me is not about posting on your social media that I was at the soup kitchen and I helped 300 people be fed today because, you know, yay me. And everybody says hearts and love and you're the best and you're amazing. And then you feel good about yourself because you did that. And they try to sell that a lot. A lot of influencers, even in the do good system, they try to sell that. They try to say you feel good about doing good. It's not about you should feel good about helping another person or saying I was the reason why this person ate today. It should be that you feel good because you're bringing some kind of equality.
Welcome to Care More, Be Better, a podcast for people like you who care about the social impact of conscious companies and everyday heroes. Hear inspiring stories from those who put people and planet before profit and personal gain. You'll learn how you can make a difference, vote with your dollars, and get involved today. Here's your host, Karina Bellizzi.
Hello, fellow do-gooders and friends. I'm your host, Karina Bellizzi. I've now been at this podcasting game for more than 3 years, and I have to tell you that I've often come across businesses, founders, nonprofits who want to come on the show and tell their story. They're seeming do-gooders, but they also sometimes lack what I would call a true, genuine, authentic feel. It's as if they're selling something, and that comes through in what they have to share. It's one of the reasons that I typically host a conversation before I even bring a guest on this show. Now, that's the reason you haven't heard from those inauthentic individuals here on Care More, Be Better, because I choose not to platform them. The ethos of this show is rooted in authenticity. It's an invitation to care more so we can create a better world together. Now, I met today's guest after they asked to come on the show and talk about what they're doing so very differently. At first, I was skeptical. I wasn't sure. I've heard so many stories about publishing companies and media agencies trying to make the world a different and better place for the people that they platform. But the deeper I got, the more I understood that this is the real deal. In this case, everything I learned only got me more excited. I was meeting a kindred soul, someone who put forward purpose before profit and definitely before personal gain as well. So it's my honor today to introduce you to Compassivist's founder, Ali Horiat. Ali left the lucrative, profit-driven world of finance in 2012 to devote himself to his vision of a society where compassion, empathy, and social impact are at the heart of our actions. In 2020, he launched Compassivist to spread that vision. Born in Dubai, he attended schools in the United Arab Emirates, France, Switzerland, before pursuing his higher education in Canada. He holds undergraduate and graduate degrees in economics, political science, philosophy, business, international relations, and conflict resolution, and also even religion. Ali is the author of 12 books, including collections of essays and poetry with themes ranging from racism and capitalism to spirituality, love, and compassion. He believes that humans must love always and always love. Thrilled to have you on the show, Ali, my newest friend.
Wow, I'm speechless. That was very kind of you. And I was just thinking, wow, yeah, I did do all that schooling.
You know, when you look at it as something like a bio and look at the rearview mirror, sometimes it's really hard to even imagine you did all those things, right?
I know.
The paths you forged.
Very true. Very true. And here I am. I think a lot of people say the schooling that they did didn't impact the work that they do. I think it did a lot for me because economics was my first degree. And I learned so much about countering all the things that I learned, unlearning all the things that I learned. And progressively in school, I've learned so much. And, you know, when I did my master's in political science, ironically, my first week of school was September 11. And I was the only Middle Eastern person in the class. And so September 11 happened. Everybody did that look towards me. And I had to explain that we are not all that. So yeah, my schooling was really a big, big part of my shift in my mentality.
Well, likewise, I mean, I had a background in anthropology, and you might think that people might not use that degree, especially if they land in business. But I feel like it informs so much of what I do because I deeply understand how connected human cultures are and how skin deep our differences really are. I will tell you too, because you bring up September 11th, I travel a lot on business. And at that time I was traveling twice a month. And, you know, meaning, you know, you're on four or five flights, maybe sometimes eight in a given month, because I'd be going back and forth internationally as well as across the United States. And it was really hard for me to see people of Arabic descent treated so differently in airport security lines and even at the gate and singled out for random checks. I was sometimes singled out with them because I sometimes had to book one-way tickets. And for a while, that was a sure way to get fingered for the security measures that are kind of going a little bit ape, especially if you're traveling internationally. Mm-hmm. So as it stands, I have a lot of empathy for everything that that must have created for you, the uncomfortable moments and just the inborn prejudice that we are exposed to because of that.
I'll tell you something about that. I was so naive at the time and so innocent thinking that I was happy about those checks. And I was traveling a lot then. I mean, I've traveled over 164 countries. And so I used to get, like you said, pulled over all the time, not all the time, but a lot of times. I was happy because I thought to myself, hey, if they're doing this due diligence so well everywhere, then chances are when I get on that plane, it's going to land where it's supposed to land. So if I have to suffer along with that, so be it, because then I'm going to sit on that plane without stressing every time somebody gets up to walk in the aisle or anything like that. So to me, it was, I didn't understand it in that way until years later when my mind grew in North America to see these kind of things that I hadn't really notice in boarding school or in back home or anything like that. And so, yeah, it was a gradual understanding of discrimination.
Yeah. Well, as it stands, we're hopefully moving in a better direction today. I see broader acceptance of people and more individuals willing to stand up. But at the same time, it seems to be something that swings like a pendulum. So you never know where you're going to land. Now, I'd like to start today with you sharing a bit about your perspective, your motivations for leaving behind a lucrative job in finances, which is something we've discussed privately, to this more purpose-driven work that you're undertaking today.
The short of it is there was no gratification when I got into the stage and the state of what I was dreaming for. I actually started out in finance, not because I loved finance or to make money. It was because I had done so much schooling that when I went to get a job, nobody would hire me because they said, oh, here's a person with all these degrees and, you know, all these graduate degrees and you have no job history. You've never worked a day in your life. And so, you know, they're like, what are you doing here? And you're overqualified. And so I couldn't actually find a job in Canada and I didn't want to come back to Dubai. I had kind of grown to love Canada, Toronto, essentially, as my hometown. And so, I mean, I started university when I was turning 16. So I really grew up there, essentially. And I thought, what do I do? You know, and I had a little bit of money. So I started investing my own money, trading a little bit and things like that. One thing led to another and it grew. And so some of my friends started investing with me and it got to the point where I was told, hey, you can't keep doing this at these numbers now. You have to register a fund and, you know, it has to be legal and there has to be some compliance. So I went ahead and did that. Eventually, the money got to me. It left the fun factor and it became, hey, I made $1 million. Now I need to make 10 million. Now I made 10 million. Now I need to make 50. And it just became this continuous addiction, so to speak. And I didn't see that at first. I didn't see that I was addicted because at the time in Toronto, many people will tell you, if you were making $20,000 a month, there's nothing you couldn't do in the city. I mean, you could live in a gorgeous house. You could lease an amazing car. Everything you really wanted that finances would buy you, you could have had. But this desire to make $100,000 a month, $1 million a month at times, it was just excessive. So I got to a point where there was no more gratification. I was making more and more and more, but it was just piling on numbers with no sense. So I had a moment. And in that moment, I just left. I quit. It wasn't really something gradual. It wasn't something that I thought about. My quitting came had an incident. And because of that incident, I went to the airport and I said, you know, I need to take time off. I need to get an understanding of what I'm doing. I'm not happy anymore at all. I wake up, I'm unhappy. I make money, I'm unhappy. Everything's just unhappy. So I look at the board of departures and they're all half a day later flights and a day later and whatnot. And there's only this one flight that leaves in 2 hours, but it goes to Quito, Ecuador. And I didn't know how far that was. I hadn't been there before and I didn't know how far that was flight-wise. And I thought to myself, hey, you know, Quito, it's, you know, South America, it's on the northern side of that. So it can't be that far. I'll take that flight. I got on the flight. Day later, I'm in Quito. And that was the beginning. I realized I'm addicted to the system. So I quit and I closed the fund. And it took a couple of years. This happened in 2016. The reason why Compassvi started in 2020 is because it took 2 years for me to lose my hypocrisy. And the hypocrisy is, you know, it resonated with me when you were speaking in the intro about people who say they're doing good, but really there's no good. And that was me, giving away a little bit of my money here and there and pretending I'm this wonderful, amazing philanthropist that's making change. But I was moving from resort to resort in five-star locations on islands and in countries that are mired with poverty. And I was not caring about any of this or any of my own footprint to add to this. And so I realized I'm still addicted to money. I'm just pretending that I'm not. I'm doing the drug of money, but I'm just pretending that I'm not. So I need to kick it. I gave away all my money, every penny, between 2018 and 2020. I even slept in train stations. And that was the 2 years that I actually wrote a lot of the material that you mentioned, the books. And I started thinking of how can I make real change, not philanthropy, not be wealthy and have my name plastered on a wing of a hospital, but actually make change in the world on a global scale, on a global level, and impact. And so I started thinking and I came to the conclusion that overconsumption is the serious issue here. And it develops from a space of spiritual misunderstanding of your life. When you're not aligned to your purpose or what you want to do or the value added of your life impact-wise in the world, you end up not knowing what to do with yourself. So you go to work, you come back, you shop. You go to work, you come back, you go to a party. You go to work, you come back, you buy a car. You do all those things because they're just the things that you do every day. But you have no strategy of what is my purpose on this world. And so that strategy of me thinking, what am I designed for? All the schooling I did, everything I've done in my life so far, the money I've made, the travels, everything I've done, how can I bundle this together and make positive from it? And so Compassivist was born because I thought, you need to act, you need to be compassionate. And together I looked for the word that didn't exist. So I made the word up, Compassivist. And a Compassivist is basically a person who acts compassionately about a cause that brings a value-added portion to the world.
Well, I hope that I embody that. I have to say that you are reminding me of another guest I've had on this show, and that is Mo Gaudat, who was the chief business officer of Google X for some time. He said in our interview, you know, he had been at the helm of any technical person's dream. He had all the money, the beautiful wife, the beautiful car, the villa, you know, homes in multiple continents, anything you could ever want or dream of. And he was miserable. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he says today that he's happier in a $5 t-shirt. And so maybe if he's dating somebody, you know, he has to tell them like, look, I'm more than the t-shirt, you know.
Exactly.
He's just not willing to kind of be in that boastful outward space anymore because it doesn't sit with his genuine and authentic center. And he founded a not-for-profit called 1 Billion Happy. And so his entire goal now is to really help people become truly centered and happy with their own lives. And so he has a podcast now called Slow Mo. I encourage mm-hmm. people to check it out. I think they would also love that show. If they love this interview, they'll love that show because it's a lot of the same things that we're talking about today. Technology is there to make our lives easier, and yet we lean on it to make our lives more complicated because a sudden breakdown in your smartphone in your hand means you suddenly can't do the 10 things that you would occupy your free time with that you didn't realize you've since become addicted to. I mean, you talk about addiction to money. So many of us are addicted to our cell phones. We can't put them down. So I think that we need to move in a direction that does acknowledge our purpose, the things that truly make us happy. And if keeping up with the Joneses next door and having the greener lawn and the newer car and the bigger house aren't making you happy, then guess what? More of it isn't going to make you happy either. And something needs to be addressed internally to address that so that you can reach your full potential as a human being and as opposed to a human doing. Because I think so often that's where we get stuck. Oh, well, I just need more.
And you know what? People who know me personally, they've understood that effect in a sense. When you speak of the bigger house, all of those things, when you speak of Mo, well, you know what? At one point, actually, the home I lived in is now a rehab facility. So it's an intake rehab facility. It's like a resort. It's that big. And I used to live there by myself. That was my house. I didn't need that. But it went with the territory. I mean, you know, you're this huge finance person in the city. You got to live on a house that's 100 acres. So all of that was available. I had a fleet of cars, everything. I'm not even going to go there, but you name it, I had it. And the thing is, it didn't bring satisfaction. It doesn't. And people don't understand that. They think if they date a celebrity, they're, you know, oh my God, the satisfaction of that. If I have a mansion in Billionaire's Row, oh my God, the satisfaction of that. If I do drive a Lamborghini, oh no, that will be heaven. But it really isn't after the experience. It's just, these are just experiences. So you experience them. And then beyond the experience, it just does not give you any gratification. Now, you speak of podcasts and the shows. You see me in this t-shirt, which you have seen me twice before in the same t-shirt. And you've seen me in the same, behind the same flat white wall. And when I was going to start our podcast, my team said, well, you know, should we put a planter here? And should we have a painting and all these, you know, embellishments for the podcast? Why? Because that's the trend. People like to see something in the background. You know, it's got to be this. What is your outfits going to be like? We have to look into that. Your haircut, you're this, you're that. And I said, no, hold on. We are going to attract the people who are looking for this. They're looking for the mind. They're looking for how. They're not looking for what kind of exotic plant I have on the side of my table. So we're going to have a white wall behind me that nobody is going to look at because there's nothing there to see. We're going to have miserable me in a simple, literally a $4 black t-shirt that has nothing to look at. So nobody's contracting Gucci for the podcast and changing outfits every show. This is what it's going to be. It's going to be about what we can do to make the world a better place, bring joy to the world. Joy is the highest value of every life. Spinoza said that. And so I believe that. I honestly believe that. I mean, this is also the same philosopher that when they asked Einstein, what God do you believe in? He said, I believe in the God of Spinoza, because it makes sense from a scientific religion. All those mangled together, it really makes sense. And so I believe that too. Mo believes that too. A lot of people who transcend money believe that because they've experienced it. It's really difficult for people, and I respect that. It's really difficult for people to understand that joy does not equate to money until they have so much money that they can't buy joy. And Mo realized that in the most unfortunate circumstances. He lost a child for absolutely no reason. It was just, you can't even think about what he had gone through. And I know this from close sources, not the media. And so he realized what money can't buy. And he realized what joy is. And he realized everything around him, from family setting to the wealth to everything, was just mirage of that addiction. That's how I see it. And I saw that in myself. I didn't learn it watching him, because I was too stupid. I was too arrogant to watch another person and learn from them. Because if we did, we have enough history of humanity to learn what's right and what's wrong. But we're just too arrogant to turn around and say, well, you know what? I can learn this from this person. I can learn this from that person. I mean, if we did learn from history, there would be no crime, because we see what happens to criminals. But we continue in the same spheres. We continue in the same actions. And I think here I am trying to tell people, it's not about money. It's not about capitalism. It's not about adding zeros. It's not about becoming a billionaire, getting that spot on Forbes, all of those things. don't add any value to neither your life nor the world around you, nor the legacy you leave behind. Because I always ask this. I ask people, who was the richest person in 1984? Nobody's ever been able to answer that. Nobody, right? Because nobody remembers anymore. I mean, we only go back a few years. We remember Bill Gates because he's still around, but that's about it. You go even into the 90s, nobody remembers. But you ask about impact. People remember Moses. That's 3,000 years ago. It's not last century. You know, it's not talking Martin Luther King. It's so far back, but the legacy somehow remained. So where do you want to be in history? Where do you want to be in your life? Where do you want to be in terms of what you bring to the world? Do you want to be that pharaoh that we don't remember, who's in some pyramid that nobody knows what the hell is built for, and there's gold still sitting there, and just we have no understanding of what this person was with all of that? We don't even know where Moses was buried and we know him. We have no body of Jesus and we know Jesus. So
I mean, these are powerful, powerful thoughts, because I mean, your follower count, how popular you are on a specific social platform, at the end of the day, none of that really matters. What matters is being able to really engage with the people that you care about and to be cared mm-hmm. about back. And I'm reminded of an earlier episode as well. I interviewed Dr. Vimal Thomas George, and he is a medical doctor. He also has a background in finance. And one of the things that troubled him after moving here from his native India and becoming a medical doctor at a respected institution and leading a whole suite on and a cardiotherapy arm of a hospital, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. He said, look, what baffles me about this American experience is that people seem to always need more, and yet they are never happy with what they have. And how many of us need a 5,000 square foot home? Unless you have an entire large extended family there, do you really need it? And so we're saddled with debt for years and years, and we work ourselves to the bone and then don't even have a secure financial situation when it's time to retire, unless we've somehow been able to amass a huge savings. And so his big pitch to people is like, look, think about living smaller. And he's not even coming from the greener perspective. He's just like, think about what you actually need. There are cultures around the world where a bowl and a wooden spoon are the things that you use to cook with. You don't have an entire kitchen with copper clad tools to go ahead and feed your family. And, you know, then I know people who get new pot sets every single year because they consider themselves culinary experts, right? And for me, I think I have the same stainless steel pans I've had for a long time. They still work and they don't leave residues on my food, and I know how to use them. They're great. My point is that I think each of us can come at this existence with a more meager perspective, learn to live with a little bit less. And I'm not talking about a lot less. Like, you can still go and get your hair done. And you know, if you want to go out to Starbucks and have a coffee every once in a while, do so, but make that a treat. I mean, you'll save an incredible amount of money along the way, and you'll also be able to have more time to do the things that matter. And I realize that this may be, you know, my soapbox moment in a way, but I really do feel like this is a conversation that we need to be having and helping, especially young people, because I think young people are more susceptible to how things look on the outside than people like yourself or myself. Like, I'm 47 now. Yeah, I still care about what I look like, but I'm not following the latest trend and thinking that it means something about who I am as an individual if I'm not wearing that style. Do you see what I'm saying?
I'm 47, but we don't look the same age. So you're doing something I don't know, but I'm going to learn that from you later.
Oh, well, my husband would say it's not clean living, but it really kind of is, because I don't eat processed foods and there's a lot of little things that I do. I guess that's not the point, though. There's a certain vanity I have about my health, and that's just because.
But it's important. That's important, you know, because this is what I wanted to get to exactly with that is we are spending on the wrong things as well. I mean, when I was living that wealthy, high life, traveling and living the life, I would go to all these brand name restaurants, these Michelin rated restaurants, and I would eat there. And breakfast, lunch, and dinner was at lavish establishments. And I just didn't know that it's garbage food. I didn't know. I thought because I'm eating at the Four Seasons that somehow this has got to be the best food that can go into my body. And so I believed that for a while until I met someone who wouldn't do that. When I said, let's go out and eat, they'd say, well, why don't we cook? Why don't we go buy food? And they were so picky in buying food. Again, for me, you buy food, you go to Whole Foods, or you go to these high-end supermarket branded spaces where everything's taken care of. Some of them had valet parking for the supermarkets. You know, I'd go to those kind of, but because I was vain, I was crazy, right? I was addicted. So those are the things I went to. So you got dressed up, you went to the supermarket. That was a thing. And they said, no, we go to the farmer's market. We go here, we go there. And there's all these spaces in Toronto and around Toronto that I had no clue existed. And I went to these places and said, wow, you have a farm that you bring all this stuff from every week and you sell it? I had no clue. This is so much fun. And then, you know, I went to Montreal, which is a city a few hours away. And they have this whole market. It's called Atwater Market. And that's what they do. The farmers bring all their goods and fresh bread is baked, like just with the right ingredients, and everything's just so perfect. So I started realizing, hey, I eat bad food. Even though I was really healthy looking, I was fit, I was at the gym every day, everything. I was taking all these vitamins that were just wrong supplements, that were creatines and things that were meant to keep my body in the shape that it was supposed to be. But inside, I was not healthy. And it was all, again, what you say, it was this excessive drive to those things. So you do that long enough and you just have no satisfaction in them and there's nothing to show for. But now scale back and think to yourself, instead of, and people in North America have a habit of moving homes. Not a lot of people have lived in the same home for 30 years or 20 years or anything like that. They invest. There's a new subdivision coming up just a few blocks up. We're going to buy early in it so that the value goes up and we're going to sell this one now. And it becomes a trend. Every few years, you're in a new house. Every few years, you're changing things around. And it's all about money. And you're still in a mortgage situation because you're spending that money. So when you're getting equity on your home, it's not really money that you're putting aside or money that you're for social impact that you can be doing. No, it's just money that now you're wealthier. Now you can take on a bigger mortgage. Now you can have a membership at the country club. Now you can upgrade from your Toyota to a Mercedes. And now blah, 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 all those things add up. And you stay in the same level of debt you were. You were at 80% debt in the old house. You're still at 80% debt here, but you're just living nicer. And that's called the beautiful life of the North American dream. But we have to do that. Why? Because if we don't contribute to the 2% minimum growth of the GDP, recession, we lose our jobs. So it's this hamster wheel that goes nowhere, which is why I thought, you know what, if we have an example of a mechanism that survives circularly in a way that doesn't depend on profit, we may be able to shift that strategy, you know, publishing, arts, music, all of the things that matter, all of the expressions, because that's what humanity is. You're an expression. From the time you wake up in the morning till the time you sleep, you are expressing. There's nothing else that you do quite as often as breathing and expressing. So, you know, your thoughts are an expression. So you can't disconnect the arts from humanity, right? So to be able to express and to be able to bring joy through your expression and to bring that collective emotion of joy in your expression is the essence of our humanity. Now, what kind of expression are you bringing, like you said, on your social media to your 20 million followers when you're only posting about things that nobody can do, that makes you elite and everybody else subhuman, so to speak, or you superhuman and everybody else human, and you categorize and you have these hard breaks in that category of what is supposed to be, that affects the young generation. You look at a lot of our greats today in terms of social media followings, and what kind of role modelship is that for a 14-year-old who's looking up and saying, wow, that's what I want to be when I grow up? There is no Mother Teresa in there, right? I mean, I'll give you an example. Kobe Bryant, right? Mm-hmm. Personal life aside and everything, he has a legacy in basketball. I mean, he was a great, but his legacy with his art and the things that he's done beyond dribbling a ball have placed an impact on the world, whether it's in sports with youth, I mean, if you go to California and you'll see his camps and a lot of the things that he's created for children, right? And there's a lot of kids who are coming up through those ranks. These are kids who, without these programs, they could have been a statistic of dead children or so many other things that could have happened in crime and whatnot, being LA. So he has impact there. His films, the dedication that he had to expression, all of his artistry, those were all impacts that he was trying to bring beyond his basketball life. That is amazing. Now you go into the NBA, the same ecosystem that he grew in for 20 years. How many Kobe Bryants are there? You can count them. You can probably count them. But out of the thousands and tens of thousands over the decades, you're not going to find that many. So you see what I mean?
It's about,
we are the people who should be leading that impact. And you look beyond that, and everything we're looking forward to in this capitalist driven system, this cutthroat capitalism, it's not even a healthy capitalism, is about the 1% or even a little less than the 1% of people we look up to. And it's probably easier to get into the NBA than to get into that team of people. So our metrics are false because our dreams just don't pan out. And even if they did and we could reach there, we would be extinct before getting there as a society. Imagine everybody wanted a Ferrari.
Yeah. And I mean, I think we have to address the question in this case. You know, you take somebody like Kobe Bryant, they can create exceptional impact with their influence because they've become such an incredible star, right? So how do we, as let's say the general public or the listeners of this show, and if Kobe's listening, hey, kudos to you, thank you. But how do we turn this compassion, this individual ability to act, into something that has a stronger, more upward trajectory, as opposed to something that's just kind of on the fringes and on the side?
So I want to answer this first. You said, if Kobe's listening. And you know what? It's not that he's listening. He's a part of it. Because if it wasn't for the Kobe's, if it wasn't for the Jesus's, if it wasn't for the Martin Luther King's, we wouldn't be here. Because we wouldn't have an understanding of that growth in the momentum of the force for betterment. These are the people, Abraham Lincoln, these are the people that we are basically feeding off of their momentum, their force. So every time you do something good, that whole community of the people who paved the way for you to be able to do good are alive in that movement. They're part of that.
So I love that perspective.
Kobe may not be listening with headphones on and sitting at home with his family, but he is a part of what's happening here right now, because I take from him and I say, wow, I want to try and do this. I learned the idea of getting involved in the arts a little bit by understanding his mentality, actually, because I read and I learned that he focused so much on expression because he believed that was a way people can come together. So that impacts this, and now I can impact someone else. But the root of all of this impact goes back not to Kobe, but further and further and further until you realize where expression began. And so all of these people are connected. Now, to your second point, how do we make impact? Well, when we compare, when we say, oh, but Taylor Swift, she has such a platform. Of course she can make an impact. And if she just didn't fly from Tokyo to Vegas and back, she could make an impact, but on the environment. But the thing is, you shouldn't compare yourself to others. You should do what's in your lane to do. There are people today, doctors who are out there in dire poverty circumstances, saving children who would otherwise die. They're doing their thing. There are people out there deactivating mines that kids may blow up playing soccer over. They're doing their thing. Everybody is in their own lane and in their own impact. So when you want to make an impact, start with the first step. Start small. Start within yourself. Say, what is it that I would change about myself that I think would make me a better person in the ways that you want to be better? And see if you can tackle that, because that challenge is a lot greater than impacting other people. Changing yourself. I remember being a child and my dad had quadruple bypass surgery. And at the doctor's appointment, the doctors smoking back then, you know, you smoked everywhere. Everybody smoked everywhere. People smoked everywhere. And when I was a kid,
putting on planes, you know.
Yeah, exactly. The funniest thing was, you know, there was a smoking section, non-smoking, and they're one seat apart. And it shows where
you. I just remember the train cars too throughout Europe. Yeah. The smoking train cars,
and they all have their little ashtrays on the side of the seat, and like it was just so normalized, right? In the doctor's, any office you went to, there was an ashtray on the table. So the doctor smoking and telling my dad, you can't smoke anymore. So it's very easy for you to tell other people what's right and what's wrong. And you're probably right about it as well. Let's just assume that you're even correct about the advice that you're giving. But the fact that you cannot take that on and make that change in yourself means you can't make impact. You need to be able to change within yourself first. So I tell people, you know what? You want to make impact. And generally, you know, your audience, other people I speak with, they're not in parts of the world that I traveled to in those years that Compassivis was born. They're not in poverty in India and Iraq and Jordan and in Egypt and places like that. They are in United States. They are in the wealthier segments of United States. They're in the wealthier segments of Canada. They're in the wealthier segments of the EU. So those people, I tell them, you know what? Shop less. Try that. Try to approach minimalism with purpose, not just to shop less and suffer, but to find joy in what you're doing, being detached from this addiction, being able to cut from this addiction. Try to see how that feels. Try to enjoy your food. Try to go out and try to find real food and try to make real food and try to eat real food and try to make it a fun experience with your family and your children so that they're not excited. And their mind is not pre-programmed to when you say, if you're quiet today and if you watch the whole movie without troubling me, we'll go to McDonald's. And that just ding, you know, like the kid just goes like, oh my God, right? You don't want to do that. You want to bring that impact and that change to make your child appreciate these lovely things about food and to learn and to change. So you raise them in that way. So impact for me is not about posting on your social media that I was at the soup kitchen and I helped 300 people be fed today because, you know, yay me. And everybody says hearts and love and you're the best and you're amazing. And then you feel good about yourself because you did that. And they try to sell that a lot. A lot of influencers, even in the do good system, they try to sell that. They try to say you feel good about doing good. It's not about you should feel good about helping another person or saying I was the reason why this person ate today. It should be that you feel good because you're bringing some kind of equality. You're bringing some kind of.
You're bringing up to me a debate I have had since I was a senior in high school, taking classes at a community college. So I was in college, right, with my English professor, and she tried to tell us that every act is inherently selfish. I took issue with this, and perhaps it's just that kind of, perhaps I'm a bleeding heart liberal, but more than anything, I think I'm an individual who comes from caring first. And I don't believe that every act is inherently selfish. I do believe that we are accidental hypocrites a lot of the time, as I think that's your point. Like, you took so long to say goodbye to the hypocrisy of what you were living, but we can actually do things that are not in our own interests and that help a greater community thrive, whether that be humanity or sometimes even putting an animal first before yourselves. And so I think that this perception that everything we do is rooted in some form of selfishness isn't correct. I would beg people to think differently and even consider what they have done in their lives that is a truly selfless act, and then try to lean into that. Try to lean into a moment in time and really then think about how did that make you feel? And it might not have made you feel fantastic at the moment. It might have made you feel kind of terrible. And I've had a few of those throughout my life. So I don't want to dig in necessarily, but I just really want to get people thinking about this.
And the hypocrisy you mentioned, I'll give you a quick example. I had a friend of mine who was a vet, and we socialized. I mean, we were friends, and he was also a vet to my pets and obviously the other people's pets. And I would give him money every month. And I would say, when people come in and they don't have money to do whatever they need to do for their pets, instead of euthanizing Because that's what they do. I mean, your dog gets run over, you go there and the doctor says, well, it's going to cost $3,000. You say, well, I don't have $3,000. Okay, we'll put him down. So simple. There's no law around it. There's nothing. I mean, it's just, it shocks me to no end that we still treat animals as property. And so I used to give money so that this doesn't happen. But I realized in my hypocrisy, that wasn't true. What was true is at parties, this doctor who was friends with me played me into funding their veterinary practice in the sense that they would say, Ali's such an animal lover. Ali's such a wonderful person. Ali's so great. Why? Because he gives X amount of dollars every month and we save so many animals because of Ali and blah, blah, blah. And Ali's sitting there like, yay, spotlight. And so he's taking it in, he's taking it in, he's loving it. And all these people are like, oh, Ali, you're such an amazing person. You're so helpful. That was what I was doing it for. It wasn't because of the animals. Why? How did I know? Because I never cared to do something about it. I never cared to advocate for it. I never cared to do something illegal about it. I never cared to change the system. I never cared to build a structure where this can be something real for everyone. I had a space that I knew would feed back to me. It was kind of like my Instagram at that time. And this Instagram would just like throw out all these posts about Ali's great every 5 minutes. And people were saying, yay,
so part of your reason did make you feel better. But yeah. At the same time, if you'd chosen to make that donation anonymously, it might still have made you feel better. And that could have been your motivation.
Yes. So my entire wealth went anonymously. Wow. That's where the difference was. And it was a big number. It's still the largest one-time donation in the history of the country. But that went anonymously. And
so in that case, you take the self-serving portion kind of out of that. And it really does come from more of that genuine space.
Yes.
Now, I have personal stories about my cat got into a brawl with another tomcat in my neighborhood when I was a little girl. And he broke his leg. And it was a compound fracture, needed to be addressed, to take the cat to the vet. And we were poor. We were actually on assisted care at the time. I remember my mom had food stamps. So it wasn't like we could just go and pay the $250, which was the price at the time in a small town to do the lowest cost surgery on my cat. And so I was there with my mom, knowing our financial situation at 10 years old and having this on my shoulders. And I look at my mom and I look at the vet and say, well, what does it cost to put our cat down? Right? Frisky. She tells me it's $12 and it takes 4 seconds. Now, that person looking at me at that moment, I thought was the receptionist because they were just at intake, really, right? Turned out the receptionist had called in sick that day. It was the vet. And the vet saw me just run out of the building crying on the way to the car. My mom paid the $12. I knew what had happened. I didn't have to ask. My cat would die. Right? 30 days later, we get a phone call at the house, and that vet was calling to ask for me and tell me that she had repaired Frisky's leg and that he was ready to come home to me. Now, that was a very hard emotional thing for that vet to do, because over the course of these 30 days, she's also bonded with the cat. So in the end, it's my belief that this whole thing was really selfless of her. Mm-hmm. She was looking at an economic situation that was untenable, that was heartbreaking, where the decision was purely based on money and resources, and she was going to do something about it. And then she fell in love with this cat and had to give it up because that was what was right in her mind for this young girl. And now
it was the Kafkaesque type of moment for the vet, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I'm tearing up at the moment, but this is like the type of impact that a single individual can have on the entire trajectory of someone's life, because it affected me in such a real way. And perhaps this was one individual and one act of kindness. But if we amplify that, if we can actually inspire people to make the uncomfortable and sometimes self-sacrificing decision to really push for change, we can change the way society exists. Exactly. We can change what is considered normal. Yes. So at any rate, I'll dab my eyes here.
I'll tell you something. That act changed you because you learned at a young age that compassion exists. Whereas you could have learned at a young age that poverty sucks. And I need to do whatever I need to do to make money so that I'll never be in that position again. And when I have a cat and a dog later in my life, I'm going to be so wealthy that no matter what happens, and that will be your mentality, you become cutthroat yourself, right?
Well, I learned both things. I learned that poverty sucks too. However, it tempered me, and actions like that throughout my life have tempered me. I care less what it looks like on the outside. You know, I care more about the heart.
Exactly.
You know?
And now you think about it when you and many other people say, let's amplify this, right? It's a beautiful concept, but I come from the finance world and I say, hold on, let's put this into numbers. If we amplify this, it means that doctor and every other vet in the world has to give up, for example, half of their salaries to amplify this. It's not possible. It's not possible. Yeah. So what do? We still need to amplify it. We don't give up on the amplification, but we need to address it. How do we address it? The collective force is not about each person taking on as many pet repair costs that are required. It's about the collective coming together and telling the government, we need a new structure because this isn't working for our family, right? Because that's what these animals are. These animals are considered family for those who care to keep pets. I mean, this is a completely different issue about animal rights and the right of them being pets and whatnot, but this is about animal welfare. So if the pet is your pet, now let me give you the exact scenario to this. You are not allowed to drive a car in the United States or in Canada or in most of the world without insurance. Why is that? Money. It's a big factor. But why is it that you can kill a dog and not have mandatory insurance? It's a life. Why is there no universal healthcare system, insurable healthcare system for everybody and every life and every creature that could possibly be into that system? Because it doesn't matter. Because that matters. There's a lease attached to that car. There's a finance attached to that car. There's a mortgage attached to that house. These are important things. This is life. I mean, your house burns down. It's life. You need insurance. Your dog dies. You get another one. That's the mentality we have. So the collective, when the collective comes together and says, hey, the next president we elect needs to address these issues, and that's where we're giving our votes to. That's the MP that we want. That's the senator that we want. That's the governor that we want. That's the mayor that we want. And we voice that opinion and we are advocating for it powerfully. Guess what? They will start thinking about these issues. They will start thinking about how do we amplify compassion. Now, what I'm doing with Compassive East is exactly that. I'm trying to bring people's expressions together as a collective, in publishing, in music, in many other forms, through a nonprofit system to say, look, let's come together and let's recreate what's happened so many times before. Gandhi in India, Martin Luther King here. It's all about the collective. It's not about an individual standing up. Great person, Dr. King. I mean, you really can't ask for more as a human. But without the capacity of the collective coming together, how much impact does one human have, right? It's important to think about that. It's important to understand that you need the collective force, especially today when everything is driven from a corporate high level of the 1% that is detrimental to the entire world. I mean, we see it over the last 50 years. We've deteriorated so much ecologically, humanitarianly, the inequality gaps, the poverties, the crime. There's 3,000 people that go missing, that are kidnapped in the United States every day. True stat. You can Google this. Everybody who's listening, go Google it. Why do we not have the right amount of policing for this? I mean, out of the 3,000, 2,300 are kids. They are children. Why do we not have systems to, I mean, we have the tech. We have everything to fight this.
And many of them end up in sex slavery and things like that too.
Yes. And, you know, I didn't want to raise all of those things, but it's just wrong. So many things are happening wrong. But then we have people whose interest on their money is in the billions of dollars annually. Where is the society going? I mean, what are we aiming at, really? That's the question everybody needs to think. When they want to make impact, what are you aiming at? Are you aiming to amplify that? Or are you aiming to amplify a happiness that you can see all around? I've been to LA many times. There are people on the north side of LA, on the south side, from Pacific Palisades all the way to Malibu. There are areas that they don't cross. It's, I mean, the whole thing is without traffic, the whole thing is an hour drive, okay? And there are parts of this distance that you don't drive because it's dangerous. And you think to yourself, the most expensive real estate almost in a country is blocks away from an area you don't drive through ever in your life. So
yep.
You look at India, Mumbai, the most expensive house in the world overlooks one of the largest ghettos in the world, one of the largest slums in India. So what are we doing? What are we trying to aim at? That's what Compassivis is about. It's about raising the value of compassion, putting compassion first, because our minds work in modules. We think in modules. You put the compassion module on, you put the compassion hat on, you start looking at every decision you make with that hat on, and you make those tough decisions. You suffer with them because we've screwed up so long. It's time to fix that. It's kind of like, I say it's like gaining weight. You go out and eat McDonald's and ice cream and all those things that you think is delicious and whatever, and you gain so much weight. And then you say, okay, you know what? I need to get back in shape for health. I don't want to have a heart attack right now. So what do you have to do? Now you have to go to the gym. You have to suffer. You have to go on the treadmill at 300 pounds. That's not easy. But you have to do that if you want to survive, to come back to 150 pounds. You need to do that. And you need to eat healthy. You need to eat foods that you weren't accustomed to. And you need to have the sugar that's not there anymore like it used to be. So that's the difficulty of fixing or correcting your digression and your addictions. They're difficult. We need to accept that. We need to accept that as part of our lives. We have to make those hard decisions to amplify compassion.
So you've mentioned in your intake form, the compassivist octopus.
Yes, yes.
And I want to make sure we get to this before the end of the show.
Yes.
Because you've touched on a lot of the things that you're doing. And I feel like I might have to invite you back to dive deeply into one or more of them. But let's at least give a taste of what the compassivist octopus is.
Okay. So when I set up Compassivis, a lot of its parts, which you rightly say it's a story of its own for another day, but a lot of its parts came about individually. So the reason publishing happened, Compassivis Publishing, is because I got a publishing offer. And for all the books I'd written, one of my friends who had access to the publishing world said, hey, you know, some of this stuff is actually well written. You know, I wasn't expecting this. And I said, oh, great. Okay. And so they tried to get me published. And so I said, okay, great. Let's go get it published. You know, maybe we'll do some good with it. I sat with the publishing people and it was just disastrous. I mean, I didn't know anything about all of this stuff. And all of a sudden, I'm like, they own my work. What do you mean you own? It's my work. It's my mind. I said it. I wrote it. What do you mean you own it? I didn't understand that. Then I didn't understand that I have to go on a marketing tour. Then I didn't understand the whole issue with print, and I'm against it because of so many reasons that you can find on the Compassivis Publishing website, including child trafficking that we touched on earlier, because a lot of these books are bound by child labor. So aside from the paper and all of that. So I said, no, I want this, I want that, because this is what I write about. And they said, no. We give you money and you just take a step up back and you don't give orders and you just play your part. And I said, oh, like that. Okay, no.
You're because the talent.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm in a position to say no, because I'm crazy enough to say no, because I'm okay sleeping in a train station. So I say no, and I walk away from them. But then I think to myself, I thought, how many people have something meaningful to say who cannot say no because they look at their children and they say, how am I not going to feed you tonight? I have to say yes to this slavery. That is what it is. It's slavery. And so I created Compassivis Publishing. And so as you rightfully know, we leave the authors their rights because I believe in that. So a lot of Compassivis' arms came about through experiences that I had. Now the octopus came about because I learned through my love for learning all the time that the octopus is a very complicated animal, you know, with multiple brains and tentacles that work together but have independent capacities and all this, and the hearts and all. So I said, wow, the society can be the big brain. I mean, that's the part that drives us together, the collective brings us together. The heart, that's the foundation. That's the nonprofit. That's where we give. That's where we give back to the world, whether it's to our ecosystems, to the animals, to the plants, to making water clean again, if ever that's possible, you know, things like that. And to people, that's the heart. And then we have the tentacles. So when we have the publishing, it's one arm that brings the collective in, not just money, but brings people in, brings like-minded people together. And these like-minded people now can start talking. They can have conversations. They can say, hey, we need to address something. And the arts program, the food program, the gaming program, the app, all of the programs that we have, there are 8 of them actually, they become the tentacles. They become the spaces where different people who have different interests in the world can tie into and say, hey, I like this tentacle because that's my thing. I'm a writer, I'm a reader, I'm in the book section. Oh, I'm a gamer, I'm in the game section. And all sorts of expressions and arts are included in those. So the octopus becomes the world, essentially, the ecosystem. And that's why Compassive East Octopus, because that's how it got there.
Well, it happens to be one of my favorite creatures from the sea, so I enjoy the connection to that. And I also think it's fascinating that you're working to disrupt not only the written world, but from the entertainment perspective, music, because if there is a category that is ripe for disruption, it truly is that. And I commend you for the effort. I look forward to continued conversations. And I think in the future, it would be helpful to have you come back and dive deeply into what's really different in the world of publishing, perhaps showcasing one or more of the authors that are on your platform so that my audience can get a feel for what types of works they can expect to see from Compassivist. So thank you so much for joining me. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you for having me. And I'd be glad to come back. I love the conversation and we'll talk soon.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ali, for all your incredible work. Well, you got to see yet another side of me today, and one that brought me to tears. That may be a first for the show. Now, I will be sure to include links to everywhere that you can connect with Ali Horiat and everything he's doing with Compassive East and that octopus, from his not-for-profit, his publishing arm, all of that with show notes. And on our complete blog at caremorebebetter.com, you will find complete transcripts to this episode. There you'll find resources in addition, even direct links to some of the episodes that we discussed today, including my interview with Mo Gaudet. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope that you'll subscribe on whatever platform you're finding this. If you're on YouTube, click that bell to always, and you'll be alerted when our next episode comes out. And while you're at it, leave us a review on whatever platform you are watching this or listening to it. A 5-star rating, thumbs up, comment, all of those things go a long way to ensure more people discover our content. Thank you, listeners and watchers, now and always, for being a part of this pod and this community, because together we really can do so much more. We can care more, we can be better, and we can build a better world that champions the excellence of truth, not just spin, and that empowers us all to build the future that we want and can be proud of. I believe Compassive East will help us get there. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Care More, Be Better, a podcast for social good. To make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And share with your friends to help us reach more people and spread more social good.